We're going to start now in Romans 18. Let's just remember where we came from, though. We've been in Romans 16, or excuse me, did I say in Romans? Forget all that. Erase that. Matthew. You can see where my head is. In Matthew 18, we just came out of this transfiguration account, and we learned in Matthew, really Matthew 16 and 17, that the disciples still aren't listening. They're not listening to what Jesus is telling them. They're listening to everybody else. Remember the key passage. We should just bring this in our memory because it's going to be important in chapter 18 as well. Go back to chapter 16, verse 21. Here are the key passages, three verses here that explain everything that they're going to be talking about through the rest of the book of Matthew. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things of the elders, chief priests, and scribes, and be killed, and be raised again on the third day. That's what he begins to teach them. That's that new information. They need to move on to that. They need to embrace it in faith. They need to accept it. And if they don't, it's going to stall their ministry. It's going to affect their ministry. And what's Peter's response when he first hears this? Does he embrace it in faith? No, look what he says in verse 22. Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him, saying, "Be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee." What is Peter basically saying? He's like, "That's not going to happen, Lord, not under my watch. You're not going to have to suffer, go to the death. Therefore, you won't need to be raised from the dead." And he picks up on that. Look what the Lord says now. And this is really the key to chapter 18 as well. He says, Jesus turns to him, verse 23, chapter 16, verse 23. But he turned and said unto Peter, "Get thee behind me, Satan. Thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men." He's thinking in accord with man. He's not thinking in accord with God. And then you go through that transfiguration account, and Peter, instead of embracing the death and resurrection of Christ, his suffering, a dishonorable death, he, instead of doing that, he goes through the transfiguration and says, "Well, maybe Christ can die like Elijah." That'd be a great death, right? Because Elijah didn't die. He was translated up to the heavenlies. Maybe Jesus can die the way Moses died. And a ripe old age at the hand of God himself, God just takes him to himself. See, Peter still wasn't listening. They come down the mount, and what does Peter say? Why did the scribes say this and that? And the question is, why is Peter thinking about what the scribes say? The scribes are the ones who are going to put Jesus to death. He's listening to the scribes, the vain religious system, but he's still not listening to Jesus. And that's where we are now when we get into chapter 18, verse 1. Let's just read through a few of these verses to set the background here. Chapter 18, verse 1. At the same time came the disciples unto Jesus. So now you have the disciples come again. And the question is, are they listening to Jesus yet? And look what their question is, saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Now, it doesn't say it here explicitly, but you know who they're operating according to? They're operating according to that vain religious system. That's what the scribes and the Pharisees say. The greatest in the kingdom are the great ones, the rich and the powerful. And Jesus is going to come and he's going to demolish that. They're looking to see who they're going to lord over in the kingdom. And Jesus says the great one in the kingdom is the one who's a servant of all things. Not the one who's high and rich, famous, powerful, but for him who is lowly. And he's going to say what kind of lowliness he's talking about here. Verse 2. So they want to know, who's the greatest in the kingdom? How do I get to that point? I want to be great in the kingdom. I want to be able to lord over others, rule over others. And Jesus said, in verse 2, and Jesus called a little child unto him and set him in the midst of them. So he goes and he gets a little child. Now, this is the literal child. It's a little 2, 3, 4, whatever age child. He comes and he puts right in the midst of them. And he's going to do a little bit of a character example here. He's going to explain this to him on who is the greatest in the kingdom. So Jesus gets a little child unto him, set him in the midst of them, and said, "Verily, I say unto you, except you be converted." Now he's going to have the general principle for entering that kingdom. First of all, notice he says, "Ye have to be converted." Now, it's important to see there, that's not something they do. That verb is in the passive voice. That's something someone else does to them. And, of course, that someone else is God, the Father. They have to be, in order to enter the kingdom, you have to be converted by the Father. And he takes you then, and of course we know that's by faith. They believe the gospel of the kingdom, just as with Abraham hundreds of years before, who believed God's good news to him. God counted his faith for righteousness, justified unto eternal life before the tribunal of God. Same way these people, this believing remnant, they're preaching, they hear the gospel of the kingdom, they believe it, God credits their faith for righteousness, and he places them in, that believing remnant, as his children. It's all something God does for them. But what the problem is they're not operating in accord with what God's doing. They're not listening yet to Jesus. So Jesus has to explain this. Now they should know this, right? Because just the account just before this in the Transfiguration, how did someone enter the kingdom in that account? See, the big thing in that Transfiguration account is you can't get the glory of the kingdom by force. You can't get it because you're rich and famous. You can't get it because you're powerful. You can't get it through your own works, effort, or merit. The only way, how was everybody in the previous account transfigured? How was Jesus? He was transfigured by the Father. That's the way you get in to the kingdom. God the Father has to transfigure you with kingdom glory. God the Father has to convert you and place you in that believing remnant so that he can usher you into that kingdom. It's all a work of God, and it's by faith. That's why he brings in the little child. What's the key thing about a little child? What's the key thing? Well, if we get out of our own society and go back to ancient Israel here, one of the key things for this vain religious system is that they held children in very low esteem. They were insignificant. They were almost non-beings. They were insignificant of the least of all beings. They didn't really care for them. Do you remember how Israel got into the predicament they're in under the courses of punishment? Let's go to Isaiah 1. Isaiah 1, and let's just refresh our memory. Why is, when Isaiah comes to explain why Israel is under the courses of punishment, this is what he says. Go back to Isaiah 1. Isaiah 1. And remember, Isaiah is a fourth course of punishment prophet. He comes on the scene, and he's going to explain to the nation that they are worthy, because of their rebellion against God, they're worthy to receive the fifth course of punishment. And you remember how that starts, right? The Babylonian captivity, and then that at least sets off that whole fifth course of punishment. And he shows up on the scene at the end of that fourth course of punishment to explain they're going to go into the fifth course if they don't repent, turn back to the Lord. He describes their situation. And look how he describes us. Go to Isaiah 1. Oh, let's bring it up. Let's start at verse 16. Isaiah 1, verse 16, wash you. Now, of course, that we could take a little mini detour there and look into the ministry of John the Baptist, Israel's cleansing program. Make you clean, put away the evil of your doings. That's what John the Baptist called on them to start doing in our Matthew account, Matthew 3. From before mine eyes, cease to do evil. Now they've been doing evil. They're worthy of the fifth course of punishment. Isaiah comes on the scene and he says, repent. and that will turn away from that fifth course of punishment. That'll push it away. Or don't repent, remain rebellious, and you're going to enter that fifth course of punishment because of their evil. Now look how he summarizes their evil. Verse 17, learn to do well. Okay, well, what do you got to do well? To counteract the evil they're doing. Seek judgment, relieve the oppressed, judge the fatherless, the orphans, the little children. That was one of the main reasons they got into the predicament they got in. They weren't taking care of the children. They weren't interested in the children. See, that vain religious system in Israel, way back in Isaiah's day, is the same vain religious system in Matthew's day, and it just cared about people that could help them, that could support them, that could they could get something from. You can't get anything from a little child, a fatherless child, can you? So you ignore them. They were just casting them aside. And in the same breath, it's also true of the widows, those who have lost their husbands. And that, when it comes to a summary of why Israel's in their predicament, is because they were disparaging against the little ones is one of the main reasons. And the widows, those who were dependent and lost the people they were dependent on and became ruined. And they just ignore them. Not something worth considering. A widow and a little child can't do anything for me, so I'm not going to worry about I can do anything for them. And look how James, let's see how we go to the end of the program. Now, all the way to the end out in this time, look what one of the main things he's going to warn them about. Go to James chapter 1. James chapter 1. Verse 27. James chapter 1, verse 27. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this. So he's summarizing. He's putting in, think of the millions of things he could have said a pure religion before God the Father would be like. We could probably come up with a list on our own, but look what James, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, puts first. To visit the fatherless, the orphans, the little children, especially those who are in need, and the widows. Just the same thing as back in Isaiah 1, in their affliction. And so when we come and we read in Matthew 18, go ahead back to Matthew 18, and you read about him bringing out this little child. See, they're thinking like the vain religious system. They thought being great in the kingdom meant being associated with the powerful and the rich in the world's viewpoint. But Jesus comes and says, no, the great in the kingdom is this little child. And let's just look at some other things. He says here, verse 3, verily I say unto you, except you be converted by the Father, by faith, and become as little children, you shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. That's the principle. That's what they've been operating on. They were converted by the Father and brought into that believing remnant, and he placed them there as his little children. Now they needed to listen to Jesus explain that to them and start operating on that basis. What's the key thing about a little child? Well, first of all, notice he doesn't say here acting like he's not referring to the things that little children do. He's referring to the things that little children are. And in this ancient society, they were generally insignificant, especially if they were orphans and left aside, considered unimportant. But what's the other characteristic of a little child? The main one, they're dependent on somebody else, right? They're completely dependent. If you put a two or three-year-old little child, he keeps emphasizing the littleness, so I'm thinking this is a pretty young child, in the middle of a street in Chicago, he's going to have a rough day. You can't just do that with a little child. A little child is completely dependent on someone else. And that's what Jesus is explaining with the disciples here. He's saying, that's what God has done with you. He's placed you in this believing remnant as little children because he wants you to be completely dependent on him. And you may be insignificant and unworthy of note by the world's standards and man's standards, but you're the greatest according to God's standards. That's what they needed to change their thinking. They needed to stop listening to the vain religious system, going all the way back to Isaiah, and you could argue goes all the way back to the days of Joshua, and really all the way back to the wilderness wanderings with Moses. They needed to stop thinking like them, and they needed to start thinking like Jesus. And so he explains that as we go through here. Verse 4, "Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." The ones that the world considers are insignificant and unimportant, like little children or like the God's little children and this believing remnant, are the greatest in God's sight. He doesn't consider the great things of the world. He considers as nothing. It's the little things of his little ones, who are dependent on him by faith. Those are the ones that are going to be great in that kingdom. It's not going to be the rich and powerful by the world standard. It's not going to be the guys running the show in Israel at this time. It's going to be God and his little children who are operating in complete dependency upon him. And he's not going to let them down. Just think of the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, all the provisions he made for them. Just rely on him for their daily provisions, for everything, for their protection, their security, everything. He'll see them through, especially that tribulation period, and they'll enter that kingdom. And now he's going to switch here a little. Look at verse 5. Verse 5, "And whosoever shall receive." So now he switches. He was talking directly to the disciples, the 12. That's who came with this question. He explains to them, "You're thinking wrong. Stop thinking the way the religious system thinks, the way the world thinks." Or as he told Peter back in chapter 16, we read a few minutes ago, the way that man thinks. Throw all that away. Think the way God and Christ think. And realize that it's the insignificant things that are dependent on God that will be the great things in the kingdom. And now it's as though he lifts up his eyes and there's multitudes there. There's the world out there, the multitudes. And now he's proclaimed something else and picks it up at verse 5. "And whosoever shall receive one such little child in my name receiveth me." So here we have another general principle. Whosoever receives one of these little children of God's that are dependent on him through faith, receiving them means receiving Jesus. But, verse 6, "But whosoever shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea." That sounds pretty serious. What he's saying there, that would be a better thing than what's going to happen to them. So you have whosoever receives one of these little children, receives Jesus, and of course, therefore, receives God, the Father. Whosoever offends, and offends there is the idea of causing to stumble, knocking down, leading astray. Anyone who does that, and leading astray unto ruin, anyone that does that, it would be better that someone just put a millstone around his neck and threw him in the sea. Now we get a couple video clips here, and that's why I called this more video clips of the kingdom, because we're going to look at a couple other things. But let's just read this first video clip here. It's really the second one. Verse 7. "Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes." So during that tribulation period, there's going to be offenses from the world, offenses from Satan's policy of evil against this believing remnant made up of God's little children. He's going to protect them. He's going to provide for them. But those who bring offenses, woe unto you. Those who participate in that satanic policy of evil to try and ruin and wipe out God's little flock, God's little children in that believing remnant before he can usher them in the kingdom. woe to them. And here we have something we've read before, and that's what we'll take a little sidestep and look at it in another passage. Verse 8. We have he gives a picture here that he's mentioned not in these exact words, but a similar format in verse 8. Wherefore, if thy hand or thy foot offend thee, cut them off and cast them from thee. It is better for thee to enter into life halt or maimed rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into the everlasting fire. And if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. It is better for thee to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into hell. And so we have here what I call a video clip picture. He's given some pictures of what is going on here. And we're going to look at this. Does anyone remember where you've read that passage before about the cutting off of severing various parts of your body for entrance into the kingdom? Nobody is. It's in Matthew 5, and we're going to go there in a minute. Don't go there yet. But what we've got through here so far is that if the 12, were listening to Jesus, they would understand that entrance into the kingdom does not come by human power and might and reliance on self. That's what the vain religious system says, but by being transfigured or converted by the Father in reliance on Him. They needed to be converted. God placing them as His children in that believing remnant. And now they need to listen to Jesus, not the vain religious system. They need to take their place, not as a greater than everyone else, but as a little child in complete reliance on the Father. They're the leaders. He's talking specifically here to the 12. They're leaders. They are the ones who are going to be the shepherds for this little flock. They can't come along and pick and choose who they want to shepherd. And only pay attention to the greater ones and not pay any attention to the lesser ones. That'd be like how the vain religious system is running Israel at that day and how he's going to run and how they had been running it all the way back to Isaiah and before. That's that. He's drawing out the point here in these video clips that we'll take a look at, the difference between the Israel being run by the vain religious system of that day and what Israel's going to look like being run by Christ in the kingdom. And his point is that they're not at all similar. They're completely opposite. They're incompatible. The kingdom isn't going to look anything like the way Israel looked in Jesus' day here, on the day of Matthew's writing. That vain religious system isn't going to be ruling in that kingdom. It's going to be completely different. All the things that the vain religious system taught were important are going to be unimportant in that kingdom. And all the things that vain religious system said was unimportant and insignificant in that kingdom is going to be the most important and the greatest. And so he's going to give what I call these video clips, and we saw this before. Let's go now back to Matthew 5. Let's go back to Matthew 5. And he's going to give some video clips. We've actually read the one we just read there in Matthew 18. And they needed to listen to Jesus at this point. And so Jesus gives them some video clips. And we're going to compare Matthew 5 with Matthew 18. Matthew 5 and Matthew 18. Now, it's important to see here, so many people get messed up by these things he says in Matthew 5 and Matthew 18. You even read every now in the newspaper somebody, it seems like it's always in California, but I don't know that, someone who cuts off their hands or cuts off their feet because they read this literally. That is not at all what Jesus is talking about here. He's using hyperbole in these messages. And the point of a hyperbole, it's exaggeration, but it's not exaggerating something to deceive or to tell a lie. It's exaggeration to drive home a teaching point. And that's what he's doing in these video clips. He's going to drive home things. He's contrasting what Israel looks like under the vain religious system of that day and how it's going to be completely different out in that kingdom when he's running the nation and being run through his believing remnant. So that's what we want to look at. Back in Matthew 5, and we'll pick it up at verse 17. Now, you should keep a finger, I should have probably said this, in Matthew 18, because we're going to have to do a little comparison. But I just want to get to feeling here, because this will, I think, open up some understanding about what he's talking about in Matthew 18. So keeping your finger in Matthew 5, go back to Matthew 18, and keep a finger in both places, because I just want to remind us about how Jesus, how Matthew prefaces this account. Look at verse 1 of chapter 18. At the same time came the disciples unto Jesus, saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" So there's the first thing. Keep that in mind for when we go back to Matthew 5. They want to know about who's the greatest in the kingdom. You're going to hear that again, but just keep that point. And then let's read the second point, verse 3. And said, "Verily I say unto you, except you be converted and become as little children, the same is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." And so the verse 3, sorry, "And become as little children, you shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven." So you have two things here from Matthew 18 that introduce the rest of Matthew 18. One is the question, who's the greatest in the kingdom? And the second is, who enters the kingdom? Now go to Matthew 5, keep both of those things in your forethinking. Go back to Matthew 5, verse 17. Matthew 5, verse 17, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill." And obviously, we're not going through this whole passage word by word, verse by verse, but this has set up, and what's happening here is in Israel, under the vain religious system, they were saying you only need to keep some of the laws. Some laws apply, some are more important than others. The ones that are not important, you don't have to worry about. The ones that are more important, well, you got to worry still something, you got to worry a little bit about them. But look what Jesus says in verse 19. "Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." So how is this account introduced? It's the same way as Matthew 18, right? The question is, who's the least and who's the greatest in the kingdom? Now go to the next verse. Remember the second thing from Matthew 18? He was explaining who enters the kingdom. Verse 20, "For I say unto you, that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven." What's that about? Who enters the kingdom of heaven? These two passages begin with the same kind of introductory remarks. They're not about the same thing. They're discussing something a little different, but they're using these video clips in the same way. They all have to do with who's greatest in the kingdom, what defines greatness in the kingdom, and who it is that enters the kingdom. And he says here, unless your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you're not even going to enter the kingdom. So you have to have a righteousness that the vain religious system didn't have. What was the vain religious system? Remember from Matthew 3, they believed they had a natural righteousness just because they were the natural physical descendants of Abraham. That automatically qualified them to enter the kingdom. And Jesus, well, John at that point said, no, that's not what qualifies someone to enter the kingdom. And he's talking about, they also thought they had a law righteousness. And he's going to show that doesn't exist because he's going to demonstrate they keep breaking the law. So they thought they had a law righteousness. They thought they had a natural righteousness. And neither of those were real. Neither of those could get them in that kingdom. What righteousness do they need? What righteousness would get them in the kingdom? It's the righteousness of God. They needed to believe the gospel of the kingdom. And at that point, God would credit their faith for righteousness, place them as his little children in the believing remnant, in dependence upon him, protect them and preserve them, and usher them into that kingdom. All right, so we have the same setup here. In Matthew 5, and 18, Jesus gives them encouraging teaching of what the kingdom will look like in comparison to the Israel being ruled by the vain religious system in that day. In Matthew 5, 17 to 48, and don't worry, we're not going to read every verse. We're going to go skip through that pretty quick. He's going to talk about, he's going to drive home the point that what the vain religious system says in that day says the sins of the heart aren't that important. God doesn't care about those. All he cares about is the external sin. And the result of that, and we're going to see several examples of this as we finish off Matthew 5, the result of that is that anger was ran rampant in Israel. There is no control on, no check on it. You can be angry as you want, get it back at people, cause fear, manipulate people, do whatever it takes. Just don't let it reach the point of murdering them. Otherwise, anger's okay. God doesn't care about that. Then what's the other one he gives? Lust in the heart, right? He gives. They say lust in the heart's nothing bad. God doesn't care so much about that. Just don't let it reach the point you commit adultery. Then it becomes bad. They stress the external sin and said the internal sins of the heart weren't important. And Jesus comes along now, and he's going to use that as the basis for showing how the kingdom is not going to be run anything like the Israel under the vain religious system of that day. He's going to demonstrate how it's not going to look like that at all. What they excuse is going to be the most important in that kingdom. Because, you know, you get the point here, right? If you can address the internal sins of the heart, what do? You automatically address the external actions, the external sins. Anger is what causes murder. So if you can deal with anger in the heart, you've already at the same time dealt with murder. If you deal with lust in the heart, you've already solved the problem of adultery. And you see, they thought the sins of the heart weren't important. And so it resulted in more anger. Fluent anger, a society run on the basis of anger. Remember, in Matthew 4, he describes the ruin of the nation under this vain religious system. It's completely ruined. There's no well-being in the land. Jesus comes through and everybody's coming to be healed and coming to receive food. And the whole nation is in utter ruin under this vain religious system. One reason is because they're not addressing the sins of the heart. They're only addressing the sins, the external sins, from a legalistic standpoint. And Jesus is going to deal with that now. Now, Matthew 18 is a little different there. It's the vain religious system's teaching about riches and power from the world's standpoint. So Jesus is now going to give them some video clips on to deal with this. And one of these video clips is the same one that we have in Matthew 18. So he's going to give some video clips. These are vivid. These aren't literal things that he says you need to do. These are things he's doing. They're hyperbole. They're metaphors. He's using this to drive home the point of how different the kingdom is going to be from what the nation of that day was. It's hyperbole, exaggeration, for the sake of teaching. And it's important for us to realize that. I think it's important to note who he's talking to for the most part. You know, sometimes we get the idea, what do we do when we want to study a book? You know, you go to the bookstore or the software store, and you get one of these big books, you know, 2,000 pages long on the Book of Romans or something, written by someone with 3 PhDs after their names, and they go into the Greek, and they go into all this. That's not what Jesus is doing with his followers. You remember who his followers are. These are people who have been sick for most of their lives. These are people who have been under adverse circumstances their whole lives. They've been exposed to the suffering brought on by this vain religious system. Most of them, if not all of them, were basically illiterate. They didn't read. They didn't write. All the information they had on God and his word came from that vain religious system until Jesus showed up on the scene. he's dealing with people that are just regular people. He's not coming now in Matthew 5 or Matthew 18 and going to lay some big heavy load on his followers that they can't do. He's bringing them now. He's going to teach them. He's going to use what I call these video clips. They're going to be a little gruesome. They're going to be a little funny. They're going to be a little ridiculous. He's using them to bring home a point. Now let's just look at a couple points in purpose and how he does this in chapter 5. Let's go to chapter 5, verse 17. First of all, we've already looked that he's described this greatness in the kingdom. And go down to verse 21. Remember, their problem is they stressed the external sins and ignored the internal sins. And we have this set up here. Verse 21. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of judgment. But I say unto you, so this is what Jesus, that's what the vain religious said. All God cares about is the external murder. Thou shalt not murder. Now, that's one of the Ten Commandments, right? But what are they forgetting? Is there just one commandment? I guess gave it away. No, there's 10 commandments. And what's the capstone commandment? The capstone commandment is, thou shalt not covet. All the other ones flow into that command. And what's coveting? Is coveting an external sin? It's an internal sin. Everything flows in those Ten Commandments flows into that capstone commandment, thou shalt not covet. And that addresses the things in the heart. And Jesus is going to bring that out. Remember even Paul. Remember in Romans, he said that I never murdered, I never committed adultery, I'm pretty good by the law. And then he came up with one of the laws that that killed him, slayed him. Thou shalt not covet. Boom, Paul died. That's what the vain religious system is missing here. They're missing thou shalt not covet that qualifies all the other commandments. It's something from the heart. So they say the important thing is you don't commit murder, the external act of murder. But look what Jesus says, but I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be a fool and shall be in danger of counsel. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar and there rememberest there that thy brother has anything against you, leave there thy gift before the altar and go thy way. First, be reconciled with the brother and then come and offer thy gift. Agree. Look at the rush he's got here. Agree with thine adversary quickly while thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver to the judge and the judge to the official and then you get thrown in jail. It's a video clip he's giving them here. In the nation of Israel at that time, anger wasn't addressed. You can be as angry as you want. You can inflict as much damage as you want. You can cause fear and manipulate people. But just fall short of committing murder and you're okay. And Jesus comes along and he says, no. And he's going to show the difference in that kingdom, out in that kingdom. He says it's going to be completely different than that. He gives this contrasting picture. In the Israel of that nation, the nation under the vain religious system, they wake up in the morning and they're all operating on the basis of anger. In that kingdom, he brings out the other point. He says, in that kingdom, everybody's going to wake up in the morning running around alleviating anger. And reconciling the brother. It's like we're going to just look at three examples here. He takes a panoramic view, then he moves in a little farther, and then he moves in so you can hear him talking. as we go through the next two examples here. He looks at the panoramic view and he says, in the kingdom, God's going to address the key thing, the most important thing is to address anger in the heart. As a matter of fact, if you look down, look at all the people running around. Guess what they're all doing in the kingdom? All the people, they're all running around, looking at them scared. You know what they're doing? They're running around alleviating anger in whatever way they can as fast as possible, as though their lives depended on it. That's what the kingdom's going to look like. It's not going to look like the Israel of that vain religious system. It's going to look like that. Look at the next one in verse 27. You have heard that it is said by them of old, thou shalt not commit adultery. So now we have, here's another one, this example, like anger and murder. They separate, they consider of no significance the lust in the heart, but they consider, you know, lust in the heart's okay as long as it doesn't, you don't actually cross the line and commit adultery. But what does Jesus say? Verse 28, he goes to thou shalt not covet. And he says, but I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. And now we have, this is the same, not necessarily word for word, but the same hyperbole he uses in Matthew 18. The reason why we're in this passage to begin with. Verse 29. And if thy right hand offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast in hell. So now we go to another step here. And before I do the second picture, let's just read the next verse, because here's what the vain religious system does. They say the sins of the heart aren't that important. We're not going to worry about them. Lust in your heart all you want. Just don't let it cross over into adultery. Don't actually commit adultery. You're okay. Jesus comes along and he says, no, the sins of the heart are what matter. And why does he say that? What does the vain religious system do now to help men? Because they don't think much of women in this society. What do? They say the lust of the heart, the sins of the heart aren't that important, just don't commit adultery. And then they find out everyone's still committing adultery. Not everyone, but many are still committing adultery. So you know what they do? Instead of addressing the sins of the heart, what do? They change the marriage laws so that the man can just throw away his wife anytime he wants, get remarried, and then go and commit adultery in that sense. And Jesus is going to bring that out. See, they just end up generating more. They refuse to address the sins of the heart. And it sets up the in anger, that sets up the conditions for murder and ruin in society. They don't address the sins of lust of the flesh. And it just results in more adultery. And their answer is to change the marriage law so strong, powerful men can just dispose of their wives for any reason. So they can get married again just so they're not committing adultery. And Jesus says, but I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery. And then he talks about severing every connection to anything that would lead to lust in the heart is the answer to adultery. Not changing the marriage laws so strong, powerful men can dispose of weaker, dependent wives. See, he's not telling anyone here to actually, literally cut off their hands or feet. That wouldn't really solve the problem, would it? He's using hyperbole. He's saying what the kingdom's going to look like. First, he says the anger aspect, he looks down at the panoramic view. And he looks down and everybody's, unlike the society of that day, everybody's running around alleviating anger and reconciling the brethren as though the gates of hell were ready to close on them, or the gates of a prison were ready to close on them. Is this their life dependent on? That's going to be the characteristic of that kingdom. The second, then he zooms in. That's a panoramic view. All you see is everybody running around alleviating anger. then it zooms in a little more, and now you see all those people don't have hands, feet, and eyes. They've all, in that kingdom, everybody's going to do whatever it takes to sever from the sins of the heart, any connection to the sins of the heart. They're going to cut off anything that needs to be cut off, sever anything that needs to be severed. And in that kingdom, they're all going to be separate from any of the sins of the heart, especially the lusts of the heart. And now he's going to go in a little further. See, it's going to look, the kingdom's going to look completely different. Now let's go one step further. And now we're going to zoom in some more. We've had the panoramic view. In the kingdom, everybody's going to jump out of bed in the morning and just be spend all day running around, alleviating anger and reconciling the brethren. You look a little closer, and they've all severed every connection. They don't have hands, they don't have feet, they don't have eyes. They just are severed from all the sins of the heart. Now we're going to go even closer and listen to them talk. Look at verse 33. Again, you have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you. Now, why did the vain religious system use those? Well, there was a good reason to use oaths, but the vain religious system didn't use the oaths in that way. How do we use oaths? You got kids. I mean, I don't know. I've dealt with kids. When are you usually using your oaths most? When you're trying to cover up a lie, right? When you're trying to look like you're telling the truth. I swear on a Bible or a stack of Bibles, or you make your oath, and that's supposed to prove that what you're thinking on the inside is the same as what you're saying on the outside. But it's really just a way of deceiving. That's the way the vain religious system uses. They use their oaths to say something on the outside that's not true about what they're thinking on the inside. We call it hypocrisy. Again, you have heard verse 33, let's go to verse 34. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou shalt canst not make one hair white or black, but let your communications be yea or yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. Now we go and we hear them talking. These ones that I wake up in the morning running around, and their sole goal for the day is alleviating anger and reconciling the brother, who've severed every connection to the sins of the heart and lusts of the heart, as though the gates of hell were ready to swallow them up, and as their life depended on it. And now you hear them talk, and they don't use those. They don't need to use those. What they are thinking on the inside is what they say on the outside. That's the way that kingdom is going to be. That's going to be the way the kingdom is set up. He's using hyperbole here, not for the exaggeration for the sake of deceiving, but the exaggeration for the sake of drawing a distinction between what that kingdom's going to look like, what that kingdom's going to operate on the basis of, and compared to what the nation is experiencing under that vain religious system. What's great in that vain religious system is going to be excluded or least in that kingdom. What the vain religious system says are important are going to be the least important in the kingdom. What the vain religious system says is the most important is going to be the least important. What they say is least important be greatest important, and it just goes on. He's using this hyperbole to show these his followers that and demonstrate in a hyperbole, in a way it's humorous, it's ridiculous, it's a little gruesome, but he's driving, that's how different that kingdom is going to be from the vain religious system running the nation of that time. And we won't look at the other two, but there's also the retribution. And you see a video clip there, the principle of retaliation. The vain religious system says, retaliate to the nth degree. Get every single cent back. Take them to the courts. Do whatever you need to do. Get it all back. In that kingdom, they're going to give them the cloak, and then they're going to give them the shirt off their back. They're going to leave retaliation to the Lord. In the kingdom, in the nation, the principle of love, they say, love your friend and hate your enemy. In that kingdom, you're going to love your enemy as your friend. He draws this contrast. The kingdom is something completely different, and he uses hyperbole to drive that point home. It's going to be absolutely different than what the nation looks like under that vain religious system. And now let's go back to Matthew 18. Okay, why did we go off on that whole thing in Matthew 5? Let's go back to Matthew 18. And we're at the same. We have the same type of hyperbole. You should recognize this in verse 6 here. Verse 6, but whosoever shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe unto the world. Notice he's talking about the world now. He's looking out. He's not addressing the 12. He's addressing the world, the multitudes. And they're going to participate in Satan's policy of evil against these little children of God's, God's little children and this believing remnant. And the point is, he's warning the world. He's warning it. Say, sever yourself from any contact to anything, this vain religious system, Satan's policy of evil against God's little children, sever any contact. And he uses the hyperbole that we just read in Matthew 5. Look at verse 8. Wherefore, if thy hand or thy foot offend thee, cut them off. He's talking about here those who would offend. Look back at verse 6. But whosoever shall offend one of these little ones. Offend there is a strong term. That's why this is addressed to the world, to the lost world. Anyone who offends, that has the idea of stumbling, bringing to ruin, leading astray, offending to destruction. Anyone that does that, it'd be better for them to have a millstone around their neck and thrown into a sea. They need to do whatever it takes to sever themselves. Thus the hyperbole, cut off the hand, the foot, the eye, sever themselves from anything that would offend one of these little ones. Wherefore, if thy hand offend thee, thy foot offend thee, cut them off and cast them from thee. It is better for thee to enter life, and that's, of course, life in that kingdom, halt of, or maimed, rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into everlasting fire. And if thy eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. It is better for thee to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into hell. What's a warning to the world is a word of comfort to his children. They're going to be offended, but God's going to avenge them of their offense. He's going to take care of their enemies. He's going to destroy their enemies. He's going to preserve and protect them and lead them through that tribulation period and usher them into that kingdom. And anybody, he's now pronouncing to the world, anybody that participates in offending his little children, the only thing, it'd be better for them to have a millstone around their neck and thrown into the sea, because it just means everlasting fire in hell. And so he has that. So sever, cut off any connection to anything in the vain religious system of Israel, Satan's policy of evil against the nation. Sever against anything that could bring offense to them. The vain religious system only respected the rich and the powerful. The vain religious system only respected the rich and the powerful in rebellion by the world standards against God. That's what they've always done. Remember, we read that in Isaiah 1. That was the main reason when Isaiah goes to summarize, one of the main reasons they're going to receive the fifth course of punishment is because they're not caring for the orphans. They're not caring for the little children. They're not caring for the widows, those who are dependent and have lost the person they were dependent on. And the vain religious system just treats them as nothing. but the kingdom of God's little children will be running the place in complete reliance and dependency upon God for their survival and existence. The things, that's that hyperbole concept, the things that are important to the vain religious system in Israel that day aren't even going to be in the mix in that kingdom. It's going to be completely different. It's run a completely different way. So they needed to feel free to stop taking into consideration, like Peter, James, and John did in chapter 17, or that all 12 of them are here doing in verse 1, stop taking into consideration the things of that vain religious system, the things of the Sadducees, the Pharisees, all that teaching. Sever yourself from it. That's the teaching that's going to bring offense. It's going to offend God's little ones. It's going to bring they're going to try and ruin, they're going to try and destroy that believing remnant. And they need to separate from that completely and be ushered in with them in that kingdom by faith. Be converted. Basically, you're going to need to be converted and become as little children. And for a Jew, that would be made members of that believing remnant. And for a Gentile, that would mean associating with that believing remnant through faith and supporting that and benefiting from Israel's program through the Abrahamic covenant. I will bless those that bless you, and I will curse those that curse you. The Abrahamic covenant for the provision for the Gentiles. The disciples needed to realize that they will enter the kingdom not in greatness and power by the world standards, but in lowliness as one who believes in Jesus and were converted by the Father who gave them the kingdom. All right, now in preparation for next week, we'll summarize it with this. I just wanted to bring out a couple basic points here. To listen to Jesus is to realize that the greatest before God's eyes are his little ones that believe in him. And let's just go through, just to kind of summarize, it'll take us down through verse 14. Then next week, we'll start putting it all together. Let's go down to verse 5. And notice something, verse 4 and 5, whosoever shall receive such a little child in my name receives me, and whosoever shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that he was thrown into the sea. And we've read that already. So whosoever receives as great and important God's little children receives Christ. That's that key, that tribulation. As they go through that, that's one of the key things they need to understand. And whosoever offends, causes to stumble God's little one, one of God's little ones who believe in Jesus, will lead to the fires of hell. And they're supposed to sever. He uses hyperbole to indicate sever all connection to anything that might bring offense, that make you a participant in offending one of these little ones. Now look at that. Now he's going to address the disciples again. So we've gone here. He addressed the disciples in the first three verses. And then he addressed the multitudes in the next verses, the whosoever. And now he's back to the disciples. Verse 10. Take heed that ye, now we're back to the 12, ye despise not one of these little ones. It's to the whole multitude, he says, like offend. Offend's a worse thing than a despise. Offend is to bring to ruin, to plan the ruin of these little children. Here, despise is to hold them in low esteem, to think of them as insignificant or unimportant. And take heed that ye despise not one of these little ones. For I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven. And so we have here, especially to the disciples. See, they're the shepherds. They're the ones leading this little believing remnant. God converts these Jews who places them in that believing remnant. And Peter and the 12 are the shepherd. Peter and the 12 are the ones who are going to come and gather them together. Peter and the 12 are the ones who are going to support all of them. Not just the important ones by the world standards, but all of them, the lowly and the meek, they all come in there as little children in complete dependency on the Father. And there we'll talk about this a little more next time. He brings out that the disciples to despise or think lightly of God's, any of God's little ones who believe in Jesus, is to despise those who hold a special place before the face of God through their angels. Remember, Israel has a program with support from the angels, the angelic realm. He's not talking here about individual guardian angels or anything. He's talking about the angels that are involved in carrying out Israel's prophetic program with regard to this believing remnant, this group of God's children. Now, that's an interesting thing, because what are we involved in? Do we, you know, you hear a lot of stories. I was actually bike riding, and I saw a sign up in someone's yard about, have you prayed to your guardian angel yet? Do we have guardian angels today? What is our role and the angel's role? In Israel's prophetic program, the angels are going to come and assist, minister to the nation of Israel. What is it in the Body of Christ mystery program? In the Body of Christ mystery program, according to Paul, we are going to be a witness to the angels. We're going to be a minister to the angels. We're a witness to that. We're going to reestablish God's glory in the spiritual, heavenly, angelic realm before the angelic powers and principalities there. Who would give up that for Israel's provision? I'll keep mine any day. That's why rightly dividing is so important. They have different applications, different teachings, different provisions. And now verse 11. We'll just finish up with this last point here. For the Son of Man has come. So now to realize that the Father sent Jesus specially to find and save his lost sheep, his little flock, from the neglect and scattering of that vain religious system. See, the 12 needed to realize the whole purpose Jesus came was to collect his sheep. For the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. And how think ye, if a man have 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, doth he not leave the 99 and goes into the mountains and seek that which has gone astray? And if so be that he finds it, verily I say unto you, he rejoiceth more of that sheep than the 99 which went not astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these one should perish or go astray or be lost. And there we'll close on that, and we'll bring that and then go into the next section where he's going to talk about discipline in the church, how to handle it when someone's committed a sin, and then the idea of unlimited forgiveness. And as we go through this passage, I think it's important to see we're going to go from, remember that one, it started with one literal child, a real 2, 3, 4 year old little child. And then it became a metaphorical little children, which became the little ones who believe in Jesus, which become this little flock of sheep. And that's who Peter and the 12 are going to be shepherding, and they need to hold them all in esteem.